This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
And in this particular session, we're going to be looking at policy approaches. So we've had already a number of suggestions about policy and how policy can help. We've also seen a little bit how policy can get in the way, but the idea here is to look at some of these policy interactions and how we can use those approaches to address some of these issues. So first on the list is looking at how the public and private partnerships may be a way to deal with some of these energy, water, sustainability, or planning processes, both planning for the research and planning for implementation. So with that, Mike Hightower from Sandia is going to give us a talk.
You guys don't have to clap until after you hear me. So let's see real quickly. Bob Goldstein and I are going to give this together. I'm already in a little bit of trouble because one of the things that we did on the road mapping activities for energy and water is DOE said, we don't want you talking about policy issues. And here they got us leading off a policy session. So Marcia, if you're here, don't go back. It's not wasn't my idea. It was Arturo's idea. So. What I really wanted to do, you've heard from others about energy water issues. I wanted to spend just a few minutes setting a stage of some activities that we've done in support of DOE, Sandia, in conjunction with EPRI and other national laboratories around the energy water issues, and mention some of that work, what has driven us into some of the road mapping activities, where you can get some of the information on background material. And then I'll hand it over to Bob to talk about some of the activities associated with partnerships. We've already heard a lot about water treatment and energy use. One of the things that came out of the road mapping activities was this issue around integrated resources management, how difficult that is, and how that needs to be a cornerstone of issues around energy and water and to address both energy and water efficiency. So that's what we're going to talk about predominantly today. So quickly, water is a shared resource. It's important. Energy and water are both increasing and are interrelated. I think you've heard that by most of the speakers for the last 2 days. And water resource management requires a broad stakeholder consensus from the environmental community, the agricultural community, all the water use communities, the energy use communities. So energy and water sustainability is going to become a very high priority, and it's going to be difficult to try to pull these disparate groups together and come around and address the energy and water issues. You need water for economic development. You need energy for economic development. Traditionally in this country, we do energy development and water development independently. We really can't do that anymore. So kind of in the past, the way that we managed water was kind of the way that Mark Twain suggested, that whiskey was for drinking and water was for fighting over. So that's one type of management approach. I'm not sure that that management approach is where we really need to be. In southwestern U.S., Agua Es Vida is water's life, is kind of the approach that a lot of the acequias and old-time water users have used. They shared the water as a very valuable resource. Native Americans look at their planning on seven generations. So when we talk about sustainability, a lot of people talk about 50-year water plans or even 100-year water plans. Maybe we ought to be looking at seven generations or 150 to 200 years when we start looking at natural resources planning and sustainability. We have multiple stakeholders that we have to include. The other issue is energy export is water export. And you're going to see that, I think, more and more often where states are looking at, we want to import energy. When you're importing energy, you're also importing water. I think there's going to be down the road resistance to exporting energy from other regions of the country because it is exporting water. You've seen this presented several different ways about the connection between water for energy and energy for water. I think most of the other speakers have talked about either one side or the other of this, but we use a lot of water for energy development. We use a lot of energy for water pumping, conveyance, and transportation. This is some work from USGS, Susan Hudson. She's sitting back there in the back. Hopefully I took your stuff, Susan, and I changed some of the colors, but hopefully it looks good to you. Susan's with USGS and does a lot of the water resources withdrawal and consumption data for the U.S. But what you can see here is that if you look at energy, energy really requires about 50% of all the water withdrawn on a daily basis in the United States. That includes both fresh water and saline water, so it is a major water user, as others have said. One of the things that we see happening, though, and has misled some people, I think, if you look at total fresh water use in the United States, it's actually been fairly constant since the 1980s. Some of that's with conservation. Some of it's the fact that industry is using less water. But a lot of it is because of two things. One, we're at the maximum reservoir capacity in the United States. We haven't built any new dams since 1980. We're really at the limit of our freshwater resources from a surface water supply. Based upon a top left-hand corner there, a 2% deficiency rate, which is a 50-year cycle. If you look at groundwater, one of the reasons I think that groundwater withdrawals are reducing is the fact that you're seeing major impacts on drawdown from major aquifers around the country due to overdrafting from the 1970s and 1980s. And so we're seeing reductions in groundwater use. We're seeing a limit on freshwater, surface water availability. We're already seeing, these are some examples. I think Tom Feely had a couple of examples in the West. But these are things that we as a group of national labs were looking at a few years ago. These are facilities around the country that have already been impacted by water availability on either power plants or biofuels plants. And so in the West, you see that there are places in the West that permits for energy plants have been denied because of lack of water. But look at the places that other parts of the country where they've also been denied permits, the Southeast, the Northeast, and even the Midwest. Places like Iowa and Minnesota that we always think have a lot of water, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, that a lot of people think that they don't have a water supply problem. But there are issues with water availability for energy development. Here's a presentation from Bob, and it's from I pulled it out of some stuff that Bob had in there. This is what you see from France. Here's a normal August, the reservoir, and look at it in August of 2003. I think here are some things. What we're seeing is this energy and water connection. Maybe we're talking about it in the West. People are beginning to see it in the eastern U.S., but people are also beginning to see it worldwide. So it's an issue that we're going to have to look at worldwide. And one of the things here is I noticed that in France what you did is you shut off transmission to Italy. All right, way to go. No. I'm sure that made them real happy, huh? Yeah. Okay. So I guess California ought to watch out. We'll close off our San Juan generating station in New Mexico to keep our water too. So, but that's things that they can do. You know, we're susceptible to these imports of energy because an import of energy is an import of water. Okay, this is just an example of the growth. We're looking at a 30% growth by 2025, almost a 50% growth in electric power generation needs by 2030. That is a lot. That's a lot. And if you look at some work that's come from Tom Feely and his groups at NETL, we're looking at tremendous growth in electric power generation needs in the Northwest, the Southwest, and the Southeast. And most of those new plants, as Tom talked about, are looking at evaporative cooling, which is a water consumption. So under the current EIA projections, we're looking at tremendous growth in water-consuming electric power needs in the fast-growing areas of the country. If you look at that, put it together, we're looking at, from 1995 through 2035, almost a factor of 3 increase in water consumption from 1990 for electric power generation. And if you look at water use, water consumption in the transportation fuel sector, looking at traditional refining, new biofuels, and new oil shale, we're looking at a factor of 3 increase in water consumption in the fuels sector. Both of these have a couple of caveats, and let me tell you what they are. In the electric power side, there's no carbon issues associated with these projections. If we look at carbon limits or carbon taxes on the electric power side, this could go up by a factor of 20 or 30%. If we look at, so that's on the electric power side. On the biofuel side or the transportation fuel side, what's not included in these projections, this is just the water for refining. If we have to go to any type of irrigated agriculture on the biofuel side, we could double or triple just the component portion for biofuels. So that's another 4 to 5 billion gallons of water a day. So these things probably are the minimum that we're looking at. It could be more significant than this. So if you plot those out, taking the trends that I've gotten from the USGS, and you look at the trends that we have in water use that Chris Rayburn talked about, both on desalination and water reuse, what you see is that by 2035, the energy sector will be probably the largest user of water in the United States under current trends. And the other thing that you're going to see here is that energy will become the largest non-ag user, a consumer of water. But if you look at what we have fresh water for non-agricultural consumption, we're going to meet a lot of this emerging demand with desalination water reuse, which suggests that what we're going to have is significant increases in energy demands, as Chris talked about. So I wanted to mention a couple of things that we have been doing in conjunction with DOE. We have an energy water report to Congress that just came out in January. That was a report that was done in conjunction with the National Energy Technology Laboratory, Sandia, Los Alamos, and EPRI. It is on Sandia website, and it's also on the NETL website. So you can get that report and download it if you want to see the background information on some of these trends and some of the issues. We have also just completed an energy water research and development roadmap. It was coordinated through the National Labs, the Utton Center, and EPRI. We had 3 regional workshops. Many people in here attended those workshops. We had almost 500 participants from the needs side to the gaps analysis side and the research side. And we're about to finish up the research roadmap report. All of these results are at www.sandia.gov/energywater. So I have a number of presentations on that on this website, as well as a report to Congress that you can get access to. What came out of those regional roadmapping meetings is, I think, what we want to talk about. 3 major elements. I think others have talked about that yesterday. We're looking at many of the regions and all the regions of the United States, the West, the central portion of the U.S., and the southeast portion of the U.S., all agree that they have current water issues that need to be addressed and managed appropriately. The only part of the country that was seemed to have not have a problem was the Northeast. Unfortunately, that's where Washington, D.C. sits, so maybe it's not as big of an issue in the northeast part of the country, but in our regional workshops, what we saw is major concerns over water availability and energy planning in all those regions. These are kind of a summary of the suggestions that they had. 3 major areas: better resources planning and management, improved water and energy use efficiency, and the use of alternative water resources. I think we've hit the bottom two through the rest of the presentations that we've had yesterday and today. And so this session is really focused on the better resources planning and management. How do you do that? How do you integrate energy and water resources planning? What are the systems analysis tools you need? What are the decision support tools that you need? What are the infrastructure, regulatory, and policy changes or improvements that you need to look at? And how do you improve the water supply information, water demand information, such that you can make those kinds of decisions? So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bob, because this session is really set up on addressing that third element, which is how do you integrate resources? How do you work together? How do you cooperate? Part of it is interactions between regulatory agencies. Part of it's public-private partnerships. Part of it's getting the different organizations within the federal government, the water organizations, the energy organizations, to work together to try to help solve this problem. So, thank you.
Mike and I never had an argument until we had to put together this presentation. I wanted him to give the whole presentation, and he wanted me to give it. And so we wound up with this compromise. Yogi Berra said, and you remember Yogi, if you don't know where you're going, it's likely you won't get there. Yogi was a deep philosopher. On the other hand, there was that frustrated stand-up comedian Einstein, who said, "I never worry about the future, it comes soon enough." as a researcher, Einstein also said, if I knew what I was doing, they wouldn't call it research. I think I showed this slide yesterday, but I think there was a bullet that wasn't on yesterday's slide, and it's an important one, that I don't think business as usual will support sustainability. A lot of the approaches that we've spoken about during this meeting so far, I think, are sort of band-aids with respect to business as usual. I think with electricity, ultimately, we're going to have to change the entire infrastructure, both its organization and how it operates. I think the key to that is developing, and this goes back to Commissioner Giesemann's presentation at the beginning of the meeting, is developing reliable, cheap, large storage. And that remains to be created. Somewhere out there in this world, there's a next Thomas Edison, and he's going to create that. And once that's created, everything's going to change. So I really think that's a major research objective. It's something that our universities, our national laboratories, our federal government agency should be really focusing on and pushing it. Here's sort of a model research program for the electric power sector. A lot of these things are really short-term oriented. They're not... There's nothing here about creating new storage, and I'll get to that later. So basically, it's engineering economic analysis of various alternatives to both increase water use efficiency and also conservation with respect to generation. Associated with that is improving dry and hybrid cooling, reducing water losses. We've spoken about this all before, Tom and I. Using degraded waters, we've heard a lot about this already, and also increasing and building a toolbox of water resource management and forecasting tools. I've showed you, EPRI's published a lot on this, I've shown that before, the value of strategic partnerships. One, we're living in a world, and we're living in a world where we've, as a society, we've devalued research. I know I've lived in other worlds. I don't know if I've lived in other worlds. In earlier times, I've lived in the... in earlier times, I've lived in an environment where there was a lot more monies and resources available to support research. Right now, it's very tight, and it'll eventually turn at some time, but I don't see that turning point coming in the very near future. So in order to overcome these limitations, one way is for different research organizations to pool their resources and develop strategic alliances, and from those strategic alliances to develop collaborative research programs. Another reason to do strategic partnerships in this area is because water is a shared phenomenon. It involves a lot of different stakeholders. We have the interests of the water supply industry, the electric power industry, the agriculture industry, the waste treatment industry. We all have a common stake in making our water resources last longer and increasing their availability and meeting the demands, and I think there's a real value for us in working together on those issues. I'm going to get to a slide now which discusses each of these organizations have their various strengths and limitations, and there's a real complementary quality with respect to their strengths, and there's real potential for synergism. So I think through cooperative research, actually, we can do, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And in this research, as we've done with the labs and other people, we share the results with all partners. And then we have a list of potential partners. Okay, I haven't made an exhaustive list of each organization's strengths and limitations. This is just for example purposes. National laboratories have just a world-caliber research staff. We've heard from a number of them today at this meeting. These are senior, seasoned investigators. They've all had, you know, they've earned their PhDs, and they've all done a lot of research in the past, and they're just excellent scientists. Where the national laboratories are weak is on technology transfer. Basically, most of their funds come from the Department of Energy. Boy, do they know how to keep the Department of Energy happy. But keeping the Department of Energy happy and working for the Department of Energy is not necessarily the same as working for the water supply sector, for the agricultural sector, for the electric power sector. Government agencies tend to think big, and that's good. They tend to really conceptualize the big problem and realize how it impacts all stakeholders. Their major limitation is that they're heavily politicized, and their ability to act on their understanding of these bigger problems are sometimes compromised by politics. However, to the rest of us, to share their vision is something to be gained. Industry, as we've heard from a number of presentations before, can offer sites where you can test new technologies, new strategies in a real-world situation, working with a real sewage treatment plant, working with a real electric power plant. You can take these technologies out to the field. The weakness of industry is they tend to think short-term. They tend to think about, you know, what's the most important problem that confronts me today, and there's not as much emphasis on strategic thinking about what's the real issue going to be 10 years or 5 years from now. Universities offer long-range vision. You have a lot of students. Most of them are young. They have the whole world ahead of them. They have multiple decades in which to live their lives, and they tend to think long-term, as do their professors, I think, as a result of the interaction largely with the students, and also they're very bright people as well, both the students and the professors. Again, the universities are weak on technology transfer. They're not used to dealing with industry, and that's something, it's just a weakness. Industrial research organizations, and I include here not only organizations like EPRI, but AWW, ARF, and WERF, et cetera, they tend to be strong on technology transfer. So they complement those other organizations like the government, the universities, and the national labs who are weaker on technology transfer. But the weakness of the industrial organizations is that they're highly influenced by the industry that they work for, and then so they're vision also tends to be highly short-term. I mean, they enjoy, and then it's great. I mean, personally speaking, what I love about working with the national labs is because they stimulate me, because from them I get this long-range vision, whereas when I work with my own members, of course, they're always pushing their short-term problems on me. Not to say that those short-term problems aren't real, not to say that it isn't our duty to help them solve that, but we still... there's a need to look at more strategic issues as well. So strengths and weaknesses complement one another. EPRI's worked in this area with a lot of different partners, and they've all been extremely enjoyable. They've been profitable to EPRI, and they've been profitable to EPRI's members as well. And I can say that because I represent EPRI. I would hope that for our partners, there was also an equal profitability through their interaction with us. We've worked with the National Energy Laboratory Nexus Program. We've worked very well and very profitably with the California Energy Commission Peer Program. The Sandia program, I think, was precedent-setting that we initially did with LANL, PNM, and then, as I said before, Sandia, NETL, and UNM also joined in. The Western Energy Water what we've done here with this whole meeting today is a result of a collaboration with between EPRI or amongst EPRI, Southern California Edison, and the University of California. And I think it would not have come about if without all those, all three partners, I think, contributed. And I don't think that this meeting would have come about, nor the amazing, if you've seen it, the poster session that was done by the students, Arturo and Bob's students. I just think that where they looked at various future, they projected what would be the water impact for the electric power industry of future energy scenarios. I thought that was an amazing piece of work. I think that's peer publishable. I hope that Arturo and the students do, and Bob, develop a paper for publication on that. And it's well, it's again, it was the interaction between the three PNM, Public Service New Mexico, has been so impressed with what the developments here have been that they've given me some money to try to establish a similar program in New Mexico and link that program with the program in the University of California so that hopefully then we'll even have more synergism having the students and people from New Mexico interact with the people in California. And as we know, the people in New Mexico and the people in California are already interchanging energy, or not interchanging, but New Mexico is shipping energy to California. And actually, of course, that energy is consuming water, so basically they're shipping virtual water to California as well. And I think California has to be concerned not only what happens within California, because as Commissioner Giesemann pointed out, 20-25% of the electricity that we use in California comes from other western states. And therefore, it really becomes not only a concern about what water sustainability is in the state of California, but what water sustainability is throughout the entire Southwest and also Northwest region as we get electricity from the Northwest as well. I guess Denis and I have a mutual admiration society. Our interaction with Electricité de France has been extremely profitable and valuable to us. We rediscovered the ammonia binary cycle, which we had totally forgotten, and I think that's a promising research direction to take. So that concludes my remarks, and give all the hard questions here to Mike.
I think what I said was
So the question is whether the consumptive use of ag is going to be exceeded by the industrial use.
No, what I was saying was the non-agricultural consumption. Energy would be the largest non-agricultural consumption. It's above domestic. It's above industry. Okay.
Okay. Other questions? Yes.
Some feedback on the projected change in consumption.
So the question is whether demand elasticity has been included in some of these models that they're looking at.
Or is it the process of being included?
Or is the process being included?
As of right now, you know, we're having to use the EIA data. And so whatever's in the EIA is using, that's what we're using. We can't really add to that or take away from that, or it'll look like two different analyses that aren't comparable. So what we've done is, and I think Tom's done that, we've got to take what the EIA is kind of projecting and take business as usual or some slight variations and make some suggestions as what may occur to 2035 to try to give an example. I mean, so we have not included detailed economics as such. And Tom, maybe you can address that too.
So the comment was go to the EIA website to get information about how they do the projections of demand.
So I guess one of the deals is, so we know all the aliens landed in Roswell, but now we know what happened to them. They migrated to Palo Alto and are working for EPRI, huh? Is that the deal?
All right. Well.
Yeah.
There was a question raised before about power plants withdraw about 40% of the total, account for about 40% of total freshwater withdrawals. And there was a question about why this differs so much from state to state, because the states that have agriculture, irrigation, agriculture, of course, then have tremendous amount of irrigation withdrawals, and so the percentages are smaller for those states. But the relative withdrawal doesn't necessarily represent the absolute withdrawal. So remember, it's where you don't have agriculture, then the percentage of the power industry looks very large. Where you do have agriculture that's using irrigation, then the withdrawal shrinks. Also, in the West, you have a lot of wet cooling towers. In the East, you still have a lot of once through cooling, so that also changes the withdrawals between the East and the West. And could I say one word about economics?
Sure.
Okay. Economic models don't predict the future very well. Economists can't produce what the price of gasoline will be 2 months into the future. The reason why economic models don't work, you'll like this, I agree with you. As a physicist, I never thought I would agree with a chemist. But clearly, we both share the same opinions about economics. Economics is not an independent discipline. There are no absolute truths in economics. Economics is not a study of a natural system. Economics is derivative from whatever social system exists. And therefore, it's a social system that decides the economics. Economics is a subdiscipline of sociology. And what determines... it's true. And what determines the future... is social behavior and social processes. And if you want to understand where the future will be, you really would do better to look at the sociology than the economics. Because the sociology redefines the economics all the time. I mean, pick up the tax laws. I mean, you have 2,000, 3,000 pages of simply arbitrary rules.
All right, so Bob got his word about economics. Be careful with this. All right, so moving right along after that comment. Thank you very much for the presentation. So next we have John Wolf from LibnoTech, and he's going to be talking about electric power and water resource sustainability. John?
Thanks, Arturo. Tough to follow that. I'm out from Ann Arbor, Michigan for the weekend. State that has a lot of water and not much population growth. In fact, it's declining. Was surprised to see a slide by our second speaker yesterday that made it look like we'd all be moving out here by 2030, followed by the population of Massachusetts by 2050. So you could pick worse places. It doesn't make much sense from a water point of view. But I want to... it's nice the way the talks fit together in this session. There's a lot of very useful overlap, and I'm going to be able to pick up on a lot of themes that you heard, especially from Tom Feely yesterday and from Bob Goldstein. on technologies in that can help conserve power, conserve water in the electric power industry. So an outline of what I want to talk about. I'll briefly talk about sustainability. You know, I've talked at a number of conferences like this, and it's almost never defined. Everyone knows what they think sustainability is, and they move on and talk about their topic. But I think it's good to establish a kind of conceptual baseline of what you're trying to accomplish with sustainability. And then talk about a telephone survey that I did with EPRI members, EPRI decision makers, about water sustainability issues to see which were of most importance to them in their business. And based on that survey and some economic calculations, a proposed research program for the power industry, some, I'll say, order of magnitude estimated benefits in terms of cost savings. So here's a widely accepted definition of sustainability: the ability to meet needs and aspirations of the present without compromising the ability to meet those of the future. And we can think either in terms of our needs and aspirations for a healthy ecosystem, either just to know it's there or to benefit from the services that it provides for consumers and industry, and also our needs and aspirations for our standard of living, to light our homes and use our computers and heat our houses, to be able to do all those things in the future and not to do so much of them today that we sacrifice the ability to do them in the future. To accomplish those things, we need two kinds of capital. And I think to get right to the point here, there's one kind that we can expand and one kind that we can't. That man-made capital, power plants or other productive capital, we can build. And natural capital, especially water, is limited. So to meet our needs for services provided by those resources and to know that it's there, it needs to be stable and resilient. And so there are some familiar rules for how to preserve our natural capital, and especially in terms of groundwater, we're all familiar with the rule that extraction rates must be less than recharge rates for that resource to be there in the future. And similarly, in terms of using your natural capital to break down wastes, which we do, the waste loads that we provide must be less than the assimilation capacities of our natural capital. In the context of a talk that we heard yesterday, we really need to increase the productivity of our natural capital, the way we've increased the productivity of labor, with both with capital deepening and with technological improvements. But the key in this area is to improve the technologies of our man-made capital, to invest as we build our new power plants, to build them better so they use less of our natural resources. To show that it can be done, this is a fact that's been shown several other ways by other speakers. In terms of water withdrawal, our water withdrawal efficiency has actually greatly improved since the 1950s. This is primarily due to our investment in cooling towers rather than using once-through cooling, but the number of gallons we use per megawatt hour is down by about two-thirds since the 1950s. It's also been pointed out that we need to look at consumptive uses, and our consumptive uses of water are increasing as we use more cooling towers and less once-through cooling, and that's of greatest concern where water is scarcest. So the problem hasn't gone away, but technology has had benefits in the past. That's the point of this slide. Okay, I'm really reporting on a project that we did for EPRI. Worked closely with Bob Goldstein. Bob helped set me up with people to interview in the electric power industry. The objective is to support the development of water sustainability research, of a water sustainability research plan that'll take a national and regional approach, you know, take into account regional differences where appropriate, and to seek partnerships where possible with public agencies. So to conduct the research, we reviewed the activities of the Energy Water Nexus Group and other ongoing activities over the past year. conducted interviews last spring and summer, and did a workshop with EPRI members as well. So I conducted these interviews, and I'd say there were about 15 of them with people around the country facing different circumstances in different regions, and tried to start out asking fairly open-ended questions about water sustainability, really not knowing exactly where things would be going. You know, asked about water quality and thermal discharge issues, as well as water supply issues. I think the first two or three bullets here are really about water supply. Is it costing you a lot to get water to cool your plant? Is it limiting in siting new facilities that you can't find enough water? And are water discharge issues limiting on siting new plants? Do you know how much water you have and how much you'll have in the future? Are your regional planning tools sufficient for planning in the short term or the long term? And the point, really, getting toward the end of the interview, you know, what sorts of research could help you given the situation, given your needs, and what are your highest priorities? And so I'll show you some quotes from the interviews that things people cared about. And there's some common themes and important regional differences, and I'll try to highlight some of those. Of course, I can't put all the responses on my slides, but picked out some that are telling. I usually started out asking people about cost, and I'm an economist as well as an engineer, so I think about prices and costs as being incentives that affect behavior. And people usually told me it's more complicated than that. You know, it's not just a commodity that we pay a price for, and especially in the West, you know, where it's a very unusual sort of a market. But that it was nearly always an important cost from an engineering standpoint, that that the availability and cost of various aspects of water strongly control the way plants are designed. Especially new plants. They strongly affect the engineering. And especially in Sunbelt regions, and where people talk more about availability than cost, that it's especially important when it's not available at any price and you have to do something else. Okay, I put together this schematic to try to distill what I thought people were telling me about the siting process for siting a plant. And the point here is that it's a multi-stage process, and that the very first priority has to do with fuels, that fuels are the biggest cost factor. If you're burning coal, you want to be near the coal, you want to be near the railroad. And once you've got that nailed down, then you think about the water. And I think the example that's foremost in my mind is talking to a company in Utah, where their power plants are located relatively near the coal and near railheads, and there isn't very much water, but they've figured out how to get some there. Again, fuel is the driver, and once you've located fuel and transmission capacity to your market for the power, and you have various water alternatives, then you cost out the different alternatives and you go with the most cost-effective and design the plant accordingly. And for that reason, since in regions like the Southwest and Sunbelt regions, they need power, they have coal, they need to find ways to cool. There was especially strong interest in dry and hybrid cooling in the desert Southwest. And whereas in other regions like the Great Lakes states, where I come from, here's one interviewee who told me he wouldn't go to dry cooling unless he had to. Because of the cost and the lower efficiency of air cooling. So I've worked up a couple of slides on the economics of dry versus wet cooling to try to distill what people were telling me about it. And the numbers here, the relationships, are really distilled from a report that was done by John Malbesh for EPRI. And the way that was done, prototype designs were done for six or eight different regions for dry and wet cooled coal-burning power plants. And the
annualized cost of cooling water was related for both dry and wet technologies to the cost of water as expressed in dollars per thousand gallons. So what the graph shows, the red curve shows that for wet cooling, the more costly the water, the more costly the cooling. And the cost of dry cooling in millions of dollars per year is independent of the cost of water. And this is an example that was done for cooling in El Paso, which, of course, is a hot climate. There's a sort of break-even cost for dry cooling, that if the cost of water is more than $3 a thousand gallons, that dry cooling becomes cost-effective. And if they could obtain water at less than $3 a thousand gallons, that wet cooling would be more cost-effective. There's a lot of regional variation in the cost of water. We heard in an earlier talk today that the average national cost was $2 per thousand gallons. So in most locations, wet cooling would be the technology of choice. And the reason that it's so costly in a hot place like El Paso is the hot weather penalty that I think Bob talked about yesterday. That air doesn't do a very good job on a hot day of cooling your plant. And that's when you need it the most, and you end up buying a lot of power from other facilities to power your air conditioners. So to try to estimate what would be the value of overcoming the hot water penalty, I took a look at the estimates that John Malbash had put together for a cooler climate for Portland, Oregon, where the cooling cost in millions of dollars per year was only $6.5 million rather than $8 million. And if you could improve the technology, operating in a place like El Paso to cool as cheaply as you could in Portland, you'd save about $1.5 million per year. So it's an envelope, but it's an estimate of the largest potential value for an for an individual plant of overcoming the dry weather penalty that we currently have with this technology. And compared to total operating costs, you could save about 1% of operating costs. So that would increase your net profit margin in this business by about 1 percentage point, which is something. Really? Okay, the cost of water. I showed how the choice of technology depends on the cost of water. And this is an illustrative example, but I wanted to break out the components of water cost to give you a feel for where it comes from. Really, the cost of water is the cost to acquire it, to deliver it, and to treat it so it's suitable for a cooling tower. This might be an operator in the desert southwest who has water available from oil and gas operations, but the cost of treating that degraded water sufficiently to go in a cooling tower might by itself be $4 per thousand gallons. The greatest cost for groundwater in this location might be to acquire the rights. One point that's been made by a number of speakers is that treated wastewater is often the least expensive available water. And it's because it's already been highly treated, so the remaining treatment that's needed is often relatively inexpensive. It might be pretty close to where you need it, so delivery costs are low and not much cost to acquire either. I saw that my time's running low, so I'll move right along here. But there was a lot of interest in the survey in reducing the cost of treatment and the use of degraded waters, even in the Midwest and the Southeast. And a slide I showed a few minutes ago showed you that the benefits of reducing the cost of water treatment by a dollar per thousand gallons is comparable for wet weather treatment to eliminating the hot weather penalty. So the same plant could save $1.5 million per year by, again, reducing the cost of treatment by a dollar per thousand gallons. Effluent from POTWs is a potential low-cost source. There are some problems associated with it that we've heard about in some other talks. Bacteria is one problem. Aerosol bacteria from use in a cooling tower is of concern, and research to see how important or unimportant that problem is would be worthwhile. But I guess the point I want to make about urban wastewater that I haven't heard anybody else make is that it's a sustainable source of water for plants. What I've done on this slide is, you know, look at growing populations in urban areas and multiply the amount of sewage generated per capita by estimates of population growth, and compare that to water needs per megawatt for capacity that's thought to be needed, and you come out with about the same number, that if you assume that cities will find water for water supply that'll turn into wastewater, it'll be located in roughly the same places that it's needed for power generation. And so it's not only a low-cost source of water, but sustainable as well. Another area for that people in the survey expressed strong interest in reducing water use was capturing evaporative losses and reducing blowdown by increasing the cycles of concentration. Got some slides here where folks in the Southwest and even in the Great Lakes states expressed interest in these technologies. It's worthwhile to look at the potential magnitudes of savings, you know, just based on the amount of water that's used for each of these purposes. I've got a slide here that looks at kind of an old standard of four cycles of concentration for a cooling tower, and the potential if you increase it to eight, basically if you double the concentrations by doubling cycles of concentration from four to eight. And you could reduce blowdown losses by about 90 gallons per megawatt hour. And you can see in this slide that evaporative losses are even much higher than that, about 480 gallons per megawatt hour. So if you can capture just a fraction of evaporative losses, it's kind of the low-hanging fruit. And there's a lot of interest in dry scrubbing and reducing the water that's used in scrubbing of flue gases. The bad news about that is less water is used in scrubbing, so the potential gain from dry scrubbing is the least of the three. I think this is the last area that I'm listing here that people in the survey showed strong interest in, and that's better regional planning tools to identify and manage their resources. And of various kinds, planning of groundwater resources, better decision tools to know about, and we heard a talk about this this morning, about better forecasts of flow for hydro plants. And even in the Great Lakes, there's a lot of interest in predictions of fluctuations of Great Lakes water levels, and better tools for understanding those would be of value to power companies. So what comes out of this is five proposed research topics, and Bob showed you this on a slide too. And so let me move along and show where this goes. I told you I had produced order of magnitude estimates of the benefits of pursuing this research. And so let me build this up from a micro scale to a macro scale. For each of the technologies that I talked about a moment ago, I've come up with a ballpark estimate of how much could be saved by reducing water use for a standardized plant, a 350 megawatt plant. For example, I showed you that the maximum value of reducing the hot weather penalty was about $1.5 million. So suppose you reduce it by half, then the savings would be $750,000. And similar reasonable estimates for the value of capturing evaporation, reducing blowdown, using dry scrubbing, and reducing the cost of degraded waters by a dollar per 1,000 gallons. And I want to scale it up nationwide, assuming that these technologies are adopted by a fraction of new plants. So look at the annual energy outlook by DOE and the forecast of new plants of different types that would be in place between now and 2030. And although this isn't going to happen in California, you can see that the great bulk of new plants that are expected by DOE will be coal-burning plants. So I've assumed that a fraction of all the new coal-burning plants adopt each of these technologies. So let's assume that 10% of the new plants do, that are in place by 2010. That is 10% adopt dry and hybrid cooling, 10% adopt partial capture of evaporation, 10% adopt reduced blowdown, 10% dry scrubbing, and 10% use degraded waters. And I want to be humble about this. It's obviously just a ballpark order of magnitude estimate, but you see you get very big numbers. By the year 2030, we're up to a cumulative savings of $800 million, and it's discounted, too. They're all discounted to the present at a 5% discount rate so that we're not adding apples and oranges. So to summarize all that, I've shown you a number of technologies that strategic planners at power companies have expressed a need for and support for. That each of these technologies could decrease operating costs on the order of 1% to 3%. The potential aggregate savings from water conservation, aggregate nationwide, are very large, on the order of hundreds of millions of dollars. Those are savings that could be offset against research costs and capital investment costs, with the surplus potentially put toward savings for ratepayers. And these are all ways that you can sustain water resources and meet the electric power needs of consumers moving ahead.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.